As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
I can't imagine the chaos that that day held. I mean, enemy breached the perimeter, right? They're inside the wire. That's something that most people will never come close to.
Well, the NVA took over a machine gun post that was ours and turned the machine gun around and started shooting it at us. And I used to get a lot of grief because I used to dig foxholes all the time. And I dug a hole out there next to the stump in the ground. And actually, I cleaned that little bomb crate and made a fight zone. And everybody gave me a hard time. But when they turned that machine gun around and started shooting it, and I was the fourth guy in the hole.
Altitude.
Tower 26 is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
What's up, and thanks for listening in. My guest today is retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Hank Dietering. In the opening clip there, he was sharing the time the NVA overran their base in Vietnam. He has a few stories to share. I really enjoyed talking to him. I think you'll love this episode. He's flown the A-4, the A-6, and the CH-53. He's a retired high school principal. I can only imagine what it would be like having a former Marine fighter pilot as your high school principal, but there are a few interesting stories in this episode about that as well. Before we get rolling into the podcast, a couple admin notes. As always, I'd like to thank my Patreon supporters. If you're looking to support the podcast or looking for additional content, you can swing over to theafterburnpodcast.com. There's links to Patreon there, as well as you can watch this. Patreon supporters get early access to all these episodes, as well as bonus content. And most recently, there's two additional segments that live up on Patreon for Patreon supporters about the no-fly zone. So it kind of builds upon that. Again, you can swing over to theafterburnpodcast.com. You can check out the swag, or you can swing over to Patreon if you're looking to support the podcast. As always, if you're listening and you like this content, just dropping a rating or review on iTunes and now Spotify, that helps the podcast out. It helps it grow. It helps it get shown to more people. So if you do enjoy it, please consider just taking the 5 to 10 seconds to swing over to iTunes or Spotify and drop a rating or review. I really appreciate it. With that being said, let's get into the episode with retired Lieutenant Colonel Hank Dietering. So we are recording. So with that, sir,
thank you for joining me on the podcast. I'm excited to have you on here. You definitely have a very broad career, not only from flying, but from teaching. And I do just want to lead into this before I get you to say who you are, because you sent over an article, spoiler alert, fighter pilot turned high school or high school principal. In this article, it made me laugh because you became a principal in 1995. The first year, it looked like you had a bunch of students who were just scratching racist comments in a bunch of benches outside the school. And your solution was to have the maintenance department burn the benches, which I absolutely love. And afterwards, the students asked, well, where are we supposed to sit? To your response was, that's not my problem. It's your irresponsibility. So I think a lot of that could be used today, although I don't know if you could do that today without the woke mob going crazy, but I just absolutely love that. And so, sir, with that being said, I'd like to jump into it and just you give, a 30 to 60 second elevator pitch of who you are, kind of broad brush, and then we'll dive into the podcast.
Okay, well, I joined the Marine Corps when I was 19 years old. I had 2 years of college. I always wanted to fly. I didn't know what I wanted to do in college, but it was costing me a lot of money, and I was working and trying to save and pay off my debts. So I joined the Marine Corps at 19. Went through as an enlisted man going to flight school. They don't do that anymore. Now you have to be a college graduate. I don't know why.
Yeah.
You do. And the day before I got my wings, I got my commission. I was very lucky. I flew A4s for about a year. Then I transitioned to the A6. Went overseas and begged my way back into an A4 squadron. And lasted about 2 months until my old CO showed up at Da Nang, and he got me yanked up there and put in an A6 squadron. And I took one of my buddies, Lenny Foster. I took his job as a forward air controller, went out with the grunts for 4 months, came back and finished up as one of the senior pilots. I was actually the junior officer, but one of the senior pilots in the A6 squadron. And then I was an instructor pilot for about 6 or 7 months, and I was the first company grade officer assigned to the college degree program. I went to Springfield College for 2 more years, where I started out originally. So I finished up at Springfield, got my master's. I asked the Marine Corps if I could do that. They told me no. So I did it anyway. I just didn't tell them. And when I finished, I told them I got a master's degree. And they were very happy about that.
So for everyone listening, you earned your wings in 1969. Is that correct?
67, I think.
Okay, 67. I'm looking here at a Distinguished Flying Cross as well as a Navy Commendation Medal. That makes sense because that's 1969. So obviously you would have graduated and then done some spin up. But the time period we're talking about, country is embroiled in war in Vietnam. It's much different than, I think, my experience going into the military and for the guys for the last 20 years. Very unpopular war at the time. Was that something that was on the forefront of your mind, thinking about, hey, I want to be a pilot, but all the turmoil that's going on in the country? Did you even think about that? Or was like, hey, I want to fly. I don't care about all the stuff that's going on in the country and the unpopularity of the war, because that's a tough thing to join, I would imagine, at that time period.
Well, to be very honest with you, I didn't think about the unpopularity of the war as much as I thought about I wanted to fly.
Okay.
When I was a little kid, I always wanted to be a pilot. Used to talk about it. When I was very young age, like 5 or 6 years old, I used to tell people I had an airplane factory. And a plane would fly over, and I'd tell people those were planes from my factory. I'd get make up the name of somebody who was flying the plane for me. I always wanted to fly, and had an opportunity to join the Marine Corps and become a pilot, and I did. I always wanted to join the Marine Corps. And when I saw that opportunity, I did. I know my dad told me that he joined the Army Air Corps during the Second World War. He was probably in his mid-30s when he joined. And he joined. He was working as a instructor out in the West Coast. He was training recruits, physical training. He was a PE teacher. And he had a job working for the government. And they were talking about trying to get this program that the Navy had. The Army Air Corps was trying to get this program to bring people in as officers. But my dad felt that he had to join the service. And one night, I'm sure he went out and got drunk and joined the Army Air Corps. And he told me that during the First World War, when he was in New York City, people would come into his father's grocery store and tell his father, "Henry, you have to be careful. They're watching you." Because Henry was a German who had emigrated to the United States. And they were watching him because he was a German and he was a suspect. And my father always felt bad about that because all his dad ever wanted to do was become an American and be a good citizen. So my father felt an obligation to join. And I felt one, and I joined the Marine Corps. I never thought about the problems of people being against the war until probably when I went back to college and again to Florida. It was not a very good place to be in college in New England campus in 1970, 71, 72. It's probably the worst place in the world to be on active duty. I remember my brother was in the platoon leaders class. He was at Bowdoin College, and he graduated 5 years after me. Well, I graduated the same year I did, but he's 5 years behind me initially. And I wanted him to be a commissioned officer in my wedding. So I called up headquarters Marine Corps and said, "My brother's finished all his requirements, but he won't get commissioned until they have graduation. Can we get it commissioned early?" And I knew a colonel up there who said, "Well, yeah, if he's completed all his requirements, we can commission him." So I went into Boston and commissioned my brother. And then we were both in uniform. We went into town and walked into a place for lunch. We sat down and the waiter brought us two drinks. And I said, "I didn't order these." And he said, "They're from the gentleman over there." And he pointed over in the corner. There were two guys sitting in the corner. So I figured one of them must have been in the Marine Corps. I went over to thank him. And I asked the guy, I said, "Were you in the Marines?" The guy said, "No." And I said, "Well, thanks for the drink." He says, "Buddy, anybody who's got the nerve to wear that uniform in this town deserves a free drink." And that's what it was like. In 1972, you know, it was a bad place to be.
The fact that, yeah, you came back and went to school. Every Marine, in my opinion, it looks like a Marine, even 20, 30 years after they get out of the Marine Corps. Once a Marine, always a Marine. And so stand out like sore thumbs. And at that time period, not something I would imagine, as you alluded to, you really, especially in New England, you wanted to stick out as a Marine. And I guess that didn't sway anything, your motivation. Did you run any other like negative experiences going to school at that time, being a Marine?
Well, I ran into them all the time. And I was on the swimming team. I had swum as a freshman and a sophomore. As a sophomore, I made All-American freestyle relay. And I came back in my junior year, I swam. My senior year, I was swimming, and then I got a job as a coach at a local high school, and I stopped swimming. But I used to run into problems all the time. You mentioned that you saw the Navy Commendation Medal that I received. I received that on the Springfield College 50-yard line, one of a football game between Springfield College and Quantico Marines. And General Jaskilka, who was the commanding officer at Quantico, came out and presented me the award. They read it, and I got lambasted in the school paper because really? Of that award. And it was kind of interesting, the heat that I took for that.
And here, I want to read it. We'll jump to this, and we'll bounce around just a little bit, so I apologize for that. But you were awarded the Navy Commendation Medal for heroic achievement while serving as a forward air controller with the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, 3rd Marine Division in connection with the combat operations against the enemy in the Republic of Vietnam on 17 June 1969. The command post and other elements of the 3rd Battalion were established in a defensive position, and I cannot pronounce that province of Vietnam, when Marines came under a vicious ground attack by North Vietnamese Army Force employing mortars, automatic weapons, and rocket-propelled grenades. Reacting instinctively, First Lieutenant Dietering repeatedly disregarded his own safety to request and skillfully coordinate supporting artillery fire and fixed-wing airstrikes, which I want to talk about that, on advancing soldiers. On one occasion, armed only with a pistol, he boldly engaged at close quarters a group of enemy soldiers who were moving toward the battalion command group, killing two of the men and forcing the remainder to abandon their assault. Inspired by his courage, the Marines fought with renewed vigor, killed 35 soldiers, and repulsed the North Vietnamese army attack. So I can imagine that being read in New England, fresh off the Vietnam War, that probably was not a popular thing. Very heroic, your actions there, and undoubtedly saved your fellow Marines on that day. So you, at that time, you know, this is about, it looks like 4 months after you received your Distinguished Flying Cross, but you're deployed to Vietnam. If you can kind of paint the picture for me, because you did some transition in there, as well as you're during this time period, you're a forward air controller, but you'd moved between the A4 and the A6. Is that correct?
Yes, I banked my way back into A4s. I had probably 400 hours in the A4, almost a year in the squadron before I transitioned. My buddies all got sent over to Vietnam, and my CO, Colonel Griffin, wanted me to stay with the squadron as a transition to A6s. So he convinced me to stay with the squadron and not go to Vietnam with my buddies. So I flew the last A4 down to the squadron down to Beaufort, transitioned to A6s. And within, I'd say, a month of the squadron, my buddies leaving and me being the only junior pilot left in the squadron, I got transferred to the group. Headquarters transferred me to the A6 squadron. I became an A6 replacement. And I got orders within a few months overseas as an A6 replacement. I got to July, and I begged my way back into A4s. And to be honest, I think I just hit the day when the CO was having a pissing contest with his personnel officer. Because I told the personnel officer, who was the one to send me to 533, I'm an A6 replacement, but I had a lot of time in the A4, and I wanted to fly A4s. And he said, well, you're going to be the A6 pilot. I said, can I talk to the group CO? And he couldn't say no. So I went in to see the group commander, and he said, I understand you're an A6 pilot. I said, yes, sir, but I've got probably 300 more hours in the A4 than I have in the A6. And I told him all the personal reasons, the professional reasons, the private reasons that I wanted to get back into A4s. And he looked at the major, who was his personnel officer, and he said, send Lieutenant Dietering down to one of the A4 squadrons. And he really pissed off the major. And then as I'm walking out the door, he stopped me and he says, Lieutenant, I stopped my chair. I said, sir. He said, what squadron would you like to go to? I said, 223. He looked at his major. He said, send the lieutenant down to 223. This is where all my buddies were. And I knew right then and there I was not going to go near that major for the rest of the time I was in July. And I lasted there about 2 months. My old CO from Cherry Point, North Carolina, came over and was assigned at the headquarters up at Da Nang. And had an opportunity, Colonel Griffith had an opportunity to transfer some people between squadrons. And he told the people at July, they had one more A6 pilot that they had listed. That was me. And he dragged me up, and instead of putting me in 225, where he transferred everybody to, he put me in the squadron that he was going to get, 242. And I got sent to 242. When I showed up, I was the A6 pilot that wanted to fly A4s. So the colonel had 242 at the time was not real happy with me. And he asked me if there was anything I wanted to do. And I said, I'd like to be a forward air controller. So as soon as he had the forward air controller slot, it was actually Lenny Foster's But Foster didn't want to go, and I did. So they sent me out to be forward air control. I spent 4 months on the ground. And luckily, I was with a great battalion. We had a wonderful commanding officer. And I served with a number of people who remained friends to this day. One was Chuck Krulak, who later became the commandant of the Marine Corps. The other was my buddy, Ollie North. And Ollie North and I were good friends. Ollie was a platoon commander. He and I share a birthday with Vladimir Putin.
So oh, there you go.
Ollie's 1 year older than me, but he was actually junior to me because he got into the Naval Academy.
The Navy Commendation Medal, you're a forward air controller. You were not flying at the time, and that's a fairly normal thing for the Marine Corps to do. At least I know today, like, it's very common for guys to rotate out and become a JTAC or a forward air controller, and they're embedded with a battalion, et cetera. So this time you've deployed as an A4, you bounce around to the A6, and then you're doing a ground job, but you're embedded with a unit and you're in the fight much more so than, you know, I equate myself as a, you know, former Air Force guy. You know, we're looking at it from 15, 20,000 feet.
Well, it's funny, but I joined that battalion and there were two forward air controllers. One was myself. The other was a guy who was a helicopter pilot, and he wanted no part of the job that he got. So that he got assigned to looking after the helicopters that did resupply, and I directed all the airstrikes. But I also became the battalion three alpha, the S2, and the engineers and the snipers worked for me. And the day 17th of June, I went to take a message to the weapons platoon commander, and I asked a couple grunts who were in the hall where the lieutenant was, and they said, "You're it." And I inherited the weapons platoon, and I kept it for about a month. So I had a platoon commander's job for a period of time that I was out there. You know, the report says that I'm not even with a pistol, but I can tell you that as soon as I get a chance, I picked up an M16 off a dead Marine, and I never got rid of it until I rotated back to the air wing.
Well, I mean, what an incredible story. So you're calling in fires, which obviously is a forward air controller. That's the bread and butter there. But I can't imagine the chaos that day held. I mean, enemy breached the perimeter, right? They're inside the wire, and that's close quarter combat. That's something that most people will never come close to.
Well, the NVA took over a machine gun post that was ours and turned the machine gun around and started shooting it at us. And I used to get a lot of grief because I used to dig foxholes all the time. And I dug a hole out there next to the stump in the ground. And actually, I cleaned that little bomb crater. And I made a foxhole. And everybody gave me a hard time. But when they turned that machine gun around and started shooting it, and I was the fourth guy in the hole. And over in the next hole next to us was a naval gunfire spotter who had come to us off the USS St. Paul. And he had been sent to us because we were going on an operation, and they figured we'd need somebody who's run naval gunfire because we're going to need a lot of it. And usually that was my job, but he was out there with us, and he was the first guy that got killed. He got hit by a mortar round. And he got killed right away, and I crawled over the holding us and to get the frequency off the radio and called the St. Paul, which is just a line station from Yankee Station where they've been refueled and reloaded. And I called the St. Paul for a fire mission. And the first question I got from the crew on board the ship where he came from was, where is Lieutenant J.G. so-and-so? And I said, he's permanently the team medevac. He was dead. St. Paul never stopped firing. They emptied that ship, and there was an Australian destroyer with gun, and both of those ships fired and blocked off the rear area behind us so that we never had to worry about them. I don't think we even called the second fire mission. We called one, and they fired until they ran ammo.
We don't have battleships anymore, but that's something that's really interesting to me. I've seen the footage of battleships that are just unloading, and I mean, it's just wrecking havoc on whatever the target is. But call, and so it sounds like you're doing a naval call for gunfire. How did that work? I mean, is it passing coordinates and then making corrections? Again, I'm only exposed to like a documentary and seeing guys making artillery corrections. But when you got a big boat off the coast and it's shooting big old bullets at the ground, that's something that really wakes people up. How does that process work, or how did it work?
Well, they actually ran, were delayed like the artillery mission. The only difference was some of the terminology and knowing how to call in the mission. Once you started shooting, you just adjusted them like you adjust artillery. When I was flying, I got to adjust the New Jersey once, 22 miles inland, and I'm shooting the bridge. And they fired, I think, one gun. They fired one salvo. It was a little sure. We gave them add like 150 meters, and fire for effect, and 9-gun salvo. And we were on the gun target line, and we knew the maximum ordnance of the weapon. We could see the rounds coming through the air. I mean, they were huge.
Oh my God.
16-inch guns. 16-inch, they were like huge. You'd see them coming through the air. And when that thing hit the bridge, there was nothing left. You couldn't see anything. It was just obliterated. It was amazing.
I mean, you're shooting basketballs like 25 miles. Like, nothing is going to survive if it gets hit by that.
Oh, unbelievable. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing like seeing a battleship off the coast. I can remember being in Beirut in the 80s. And New Jersey was over there. And they would just come down the coast. They would train the guns on the, as they went by, they would just sort of swing the guns towards the, you know, towards the shore. And everybody on the shore would look at that thing and it would scare the hell out of them. The new ships don't look that way.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I feel sorry for the pilots today. A couple of years ago, I was down at Qualico at a reunion, and I talked to two majors who were there having breakfast outside of the base. And I talked to them, and they had both done two tours over the sandbox. I think one was in Iraq, and I don't know the other one was where they were. They'd done two tours over there. They'd never flown a mission below 17,000 feet. And I said to them, you got to be kidding me. 17,000 feet, the only time we get that high is when we're flying test off. You know, sometimes we climb to 12,000, you know, TPQ hop, and they go, well, what's TPQ? And I'd explain it. That was when the weather was so bad that you couldn't see the ground. They would give you an altitude, the airspeed, and have you fly at a certain heading. And then if you release the bomb when they told you to, it should, you know, it should fall into the target. But most of the time we flew, you know, a couple thousand feet. And they said, well, what's the lowest you flew? And I said, well, we used to drop an A-bomb around 100 feet. And they couldn't believe these guys had never been below 17,000 feet on a mission. And I was flying airplanes that probably cost, you know, less than $1 million a piece. And the helmets cost $1 million now.
Right.
I can remember thinking to myself that nobody's going to hit me, which is, I think, why the Israeli state guys ran out of high school. They're young, they have the best reflexes they ever had, and they think they're invincible. Nothing's going to hurt them.
That's very true. It's funny you mentioned that because, yeah, everything we do is medium altitude, some shows of force down at 500 feet, and that's about it. Everything else, you know, you're dropping JDAMs or laser-guided weapons, mid-teens, and you want to be at 0.95, give that bomb as much energy as possible. But I did a red flag. The Israelis were there, and, you know, the SAM operators out there, they have cameras, and they're videoing a lot of this stuff, and the Israelis. It was, I remember watching one of these things. It was at night, and this is 7 years ago, and you could see the dirt being kicked up in the camera. They were flying so low. They still do it. You know, I mean, they're down there. These guys had to be at 20 feet, 20, 50 feet, just hugging the terrain, zipping around at night on NVGs, flying around as Meagles. It was wild stuff.
I was telling somebody that if your gun sight didn't work in the A4, it was not a damning discrepancy. you just put a grease pencil mark in between, I think it was the second and third rivet was where it fell off, and the first and second rivet was where if you shot, you know, in shooting a rocket. But if your bomb sight didn't work, it wasn't a down. You just go out there and wing it. And I can remember inventing some ordnance delivery. Once I had a mission on the side of a hill, and there was like 500-foot overcast. So we came in at like 100 feet, pulled up, and lofted our bombs. We had snake eyes and napalm. We would loft them into the target, pull up into the overcast, do a wing over, and come out on a reciprocal heading, drop down to 500 feet, swing around, low, get lower and lower, drop in again, pull your nose up. And they wanted you in a little longer, you'd wait a little bit more. Sure, you'd let it go a little bit sooner. We were inventing the weapons delivery.
But you had no moving map, right? You're doing this probably off like a topo map on your leg, and then an INS, which I imagine probably has a pretty good drift rate back in the day.
We didn't
how are you guys navigate? How are you guys navigating below the weather? That's a little sporty.
You just. When I went to flight school, we used to use Texaco maps for our day VFR visual reconnaissance. Now, when I went to flight school, if you flew out of the training area, you got it down, and you had to know where it was. You had to visually keep yourself oriented. And there was no controller, nobody telling you you got to go out of the area, turn left. Turn right. You know, you had to know where the field was. You had to be able to find the outlying field, but you had to be able to find those fields. Instructor would say, go to Faircloth Field. You had to know where it was. You had to find it. So that's how we flew.
No big deal. No big deal. This is back when men were fighter pilots. I mean, the thought of dropping through the weather, it does happen. I mean, I did it, but I did it over Syria. And I knew the terrain was flat. Right. And, you know, you're only going to go down so far. But dropping around in the hills of Vietnam, I'd say it feels a little sporty to me. I'm impressed.
Well, I can remember flying over in Laos. I flew A-6s. We flew a lot over in Laos at the Rat Package there. And we used to love it when there was thunderstorms because you'd be getting the thunderstorm and you'd be hidden from the guys on the ground. Otherwise, you're on a clear night. You'd fly along, and every time you hit a turn point, you'd change your altitude, your airspeed a little bit, particularly your airspeed, so that if they tried to gauge where you were going to be, they'd set up a sector of fire. They'd just fill a block of space. If you were in it, the fastest way to get out was to go straight ahead. Now, if you turned, you were going to be in longer. But I can remember sometimes you'd slow down, and you'd see the fire in front of you, you'd speed up, you'd see it behind you. And you have to turn and run out of the next leg. So we used to love to get inside the thunderstorms. And we used to get St. Elmo's fire in the cockpit. A lot of times in the A6, you'd get a ball of like sparks. It would come up there was this canopy that was divided, and there was a steel rail in the center between you and the bombing and navigator. And the ball would come up, and if you had a new navigator never seen it before, you could hit it with your hand, it would just disappear. It would scare the daylights out of your navigator. And the other thing we used to get was we'd fly in the bad weather, and you'd have all these sparks out on the leading edge of the wings, and on all your bombs, you'd have sparks on the fuses of all the bombs that you'd see them out there, little bolts of lightning coming off. And of course, it wouldn't bother anything. They had to be released, and they had a propeller on the front that had spit a certain number of times.
Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. It can save you time and money, so you provide your family with a financial safety net starting today. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius gives you unbiased advice from a licensed expert. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot from customers who have found the best fit for their needs. Policy Genius helps you compare your options from top companies and their teams of licensed experts. Talk to a team of award-winning agents who will walk you through the process step by step. Easily compare quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. Your work life insurance policy might not be enough to protect your family's needs. Finding the right policy can be time-consuming and overwhelming. Let Policy Genius help you find the right policy and protect your family today.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
I will say this. You might be the first pilot I've ever met that said, we just like flying in thunderstorms. But I can understand the reason of why you like flying in thunderstorms versus that surface-to-air threat had to be incredible there. Can you talk to me a little bit about what that was like? I know you'd mentioned changing airspeeds and altitudes. Was it pretty intense during that 1969, 1970 time period you were there?
Sometimes it was. Sometimes it was funny. We'd get a brief at the group headquarters, and they'd tell us where the AAA was. And they would tell us where we could fire and where we couldn't. The few times that we got to go up north before they shut down planes going up in the north, they would tell us where we couldn't fire. And they had AAA on top of schools and on top of hospitals and places, and just begging you to take a shot at them. So they would tell you, don't anybody shoot it back at these places. You don't want to take one out. You're going to be taken out of school or hospital. I can remember when Jane Fonda was up in Hanoi, everybody wanted to know where she was. Nobody would tell us.
Somebody
probably would have gotten up there on their own just for the hell of it. Try to figure out.
Yeah, I just remember. Whoops.
When we went, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but when I was flying out of July in A4s, we used to take off with rockets a lot of times. And we'd take off, the weather was bad, and they'd give us the TPQ bombing run, and we'd bring the rockets home. And the ground crews hated us to come in home with rockets, especially in 19-shot pods, because the rockets would fall out when you landed. We couldn't make an arrested landing with many rockets on board. They had to go out to the de-arming area and a de-arming airplane take the rockets off. So we'd finish our TPQ and they'd tell us, we'd be up close to the DMZ, and they'd tell us, to brake left or brake right 180 degrees after you release, brake left or brake right so you don't cross the red zone. And we'd just give somebody the old arm your rocket signal. And we'd drop the bombs and we'd pull our nose up 45 degrees, launch the rockets, and break you off and hit south. I always wondered what the dispersion was on 45-degree loft at about 14,000 feet on a 19-shot rocket pod. Probably some poor farmer up there.
I can't imagine what the dispersion rate on that is. Can you talk to me a little bit about your distinguished flying cross? So I'll read an excerpt here as we kind of go jump back a few months from talking about the attack on the base. But early on, I think in the deployment there for you on the 9th of February, 1969, you're a wingman in flight of two A4 Skyhawks and assigned to provide close air support for a Marine unit that was heavily engaged with the North Vietnamese Army Company south of Da Nang. And so despite extreme darkness and a low cloud cover, you expeditiously directed your aircraft to a designated area and informed by the tactical air controller, airborne, the proximity of friendlies and the enemy positions, which require precision ordnance delivery. And disregarding your own safety, you immediately commenced a determined attack upon hostile emplacements and came under heavy volume of hostile small arms fire and machine gun fire. And ignoring the intense fire, you fearlessly maneuvered your aircraft over the hazardous target area during repeated bombing runs, delivering ordnance to devastating effectiveness. So this repulsed the attack again and undoubtedly saved lots of Marines' lives on that day. But you're doing it at night and you're doing it under cloud cover. No NVGs, no precision-guided weapons. Again, this is a much different time period for those that are listening. And if you just kind of, I mean, for me, I'm trying to put myself in that scenario. And I guess, yeah, you didn't know what you didn't know at the time, not having all that technology. But now I think about jumping back into that very scenario, that's incredibly sporty and dangerous.
Well, we used to do things like that all the time. And I think, you know, I got in the single flying course because somebody on the ground decided to write us up. Or I probably flew better missions and more dangerous missions in a number of cases. I can tell you one night, our squadron had the hot pad, and there was a USO show up in July. So I think Wayne Rogers and I were the two guys that said we'd stick around and fly a third mission. So we flew a third mission, and it was crummy weather and overcast, and the grunts on the ground really needed more help. And we were making runs, dropping one bomb at a time, just so we could make a lot of runs and let the grunts maneuver. And we came back, and we knew where they were, that they needed help, so we told the duty officer we would go out again, and Wayne and I flew our fourth hut. And we went out, went back up, we took off, we flew back, knew where to go, and we helped those guys out. We came back and we got grounded. Wayne and I got grounded for flying four hours without permission. Yeah. We were allowed to fly three with the CO's permission, and we had group commander's permission to fly the fourth hut. We didn't even think about it. We just knew that those guys needed help and we were going to help. So we went out there. We got grounded. So it was one of the... I think I get grounded every rank I held up to manager. So,
you know, you're doing it right. And I don't just look at 250 combat missions is what you flew. Is that the same year, or is that over the course of your career?
No, that was in Vietnam. I flew 184. I had 99 when I left.
Okay.
I went up to Da Nang. My CO let me go back to Da Nang, or back to July. And the CO, they let me fly my 100th mission in the A4. And I flew 150 in the A6 and spent 4 months in Fort Victor. There were guys that flew like 300 missions. I flew the night before I came home. I had a hot. Most guys quit flying about a week before they went home, but I flew the night before I left. And I went out to my airplane. I was supposed to have six rock eyes. I had wall-to-roll rock eyes. I think I had 28 rock eyes, which are cluster bombs. And when I didn't know, I found out later that the ordnance men and the ground crews were having a bet as to how many I would bring back. And the guy who won was the guy who said it wouldn't be very heavy.
Yeah, it's not worth your salt if you bring anything back on the last one. I mean, incredible the number you had there. Again, most people don't touch that, especially in such a contested environment that you're operating in. I would say, obviously, it's very, very dangerous, and a lot of guys didn't come back from it. And also just looking at your biography, you have a Purple Heart as well. Can you talk about that?
Well, that happened on the 17th of June when I received that commendation. And to be honest with you, I didn't know that I was wounded. My radio operator said, "You okay, Lieutenant?" I said, "Yeah, why?" He said, "We're bleeding pretty bad." I was walking through the lines, and I'd spotted an NV soldier in a hole. And I said, "Somebody tossed me a frag." Well, he threw one out of the hole. And the first one, I got another eject and it went off. I don't know if it hit me or not. But the second one he threw, I was on my hands and my knees getting up when he threw the second one. They rolled underneath me. It never dawned on me that I could have laid down on top of it and saved a bunch of people. I just took off thinking to myself, if I'm really fast, I'll only lose my legs. And I probably got more than like 15, 20 feet away when it went off. And I had shrapnel wounds in both arms and both legs. I later got shot in the arm as well. That was the it says that I was requesting fixed-wing airstrikes, but the truth of it is, my radio operator did most of that. I was out walking through the field doing a bunch of stuff that I shouldn't be doing.
I got this pilot out here with a pistol and an M16 just cleaning up shop. That's incredible. But you obviously are injured from that, but you're still staying. Like you get bandaged up and then back to it, right? Like you're not coming stateside and spending 6 months of R&R and then going back to the fight.
I was walking wounded. I can remember that night I was sitting in a hole and Colonel Schultz came over and brought me a long rat. Just something, something to eat, right? Rice and beans or something. Hot meal. He just gave me a couple spoonfuls of his long rat. And then the corpsman came by and tossed me a couple battle dressings and some sulfur powder. And that's what I put on my wounds because he had more important people to take care of. We had, I don't know how many guys got killed that day, but I think there were 70 of us and probably 10 guys that did get wounded. That command group, almost everybody in the command group got wounded or killed. A lot of guys got killed that day. So I was extremely lucky. But I think back on that day, I think that's the day I shouldn't have survived.
I was in Afghanistan. The Marine Harrier Squadron was at Kandahar, and they ended up moving over to Camp Bastion. And about a month after I left, the Taliban had breached Camp Bastion, which is in Camp Leatherneck, same complex, very big base in Helmand Province. But the Marine CO, the Harrier Squadron, he was killed during the breach. But all these Marines, these fighter pilots, all they have is their M9, and they're charging the Taliban, trying to fight them. They destroyed several Harriers in that. Again, several Marines were killed during that breach. It's just something that's, I would say, relatively uncommon, especially at big bases for what has happened the last 20 years. Undoubtedly, it happened, and that's one example. But I imagine during that time period, that's something that's a little bit more commonplace to have the Viet Cong, North Vietnamese Army reaching the wire and attacking the different forward operating bases.
Well, the Marines have a unique perspective on things. Everybody's a rifleman. And I was an instructor at the officers' basic school for 2 years. I had two platoons, and then I taught company tactics. And I worked for the guy who was the battalion commander when I was in Vietnam. He came and CO of the basic school and got me to sign there when I got sent to Quantico. He got me a job at the basic school. But the basic school was a place where we taught everybody that went through officers' candidate school or one of the military academies, they came to the basic school and they learned how to be a platoon commander. And that's what we taught them, basic platoon commander stuff. Then they went to flight school, if they were going to flight school. But first they had to go to the basic school and learn what it took to be a platoon commander. But I know that they're still doing something very similar. So everybody had that training. Not everybody became a platoon commander, but they all had the background. They all learned how to do it. And it's not unusual for Marines to have assignments where they pick up a rifle. They might be in the airway, but they defend the perimeter. One of the enlisted men who was a plane captain in our A6 squadron, Bob Foley, remains a good friend of mine. And I know that Bob spent 3 or 4 months as one of the security guys perimeter of the base at Da Nang. He was out there every night with a rifle watch you at perimeter.
I'll say, too, my experience when I was in Kandahar, I was working a lot with the Marines, specifically the KC-130, which Marine Transport did tanking, and then they loaded out with Griffin and Hellfire missiles. So they would be flying around southern Afghanistan doing resupplies for the Marines. But if a troops in contact kicked off or a high value target popped up, this C-130 would just, 90 left, get the coordinates and would rip off a Hellfire or Griffin missiles. And the Taliban, they had no idea. They knew if they heard a Predator, the UAV flying around, they would run and hide. They wouldn't run and hide from fighters because at the time the ROEs were so restrictive. They knew that the U.S. or the coalition wouldn't drop bombs. But they didn't know about that KC-130. They just thought it was a transport. And the Marines, again, they decked it out with a sweet optics, all sorts of stuff. And they would call it actually the triangle of death between the British JTAC and Hellman, this Marine C-130 that would just go wreck havoc. But I went over to Camp Bastion. Again, the thing, as you kind of alluded to, that fascinated me is I was watching several documentaries, reading books at the time, because the war had been going on for almost a decade at that point when I was there. But I saw several of the Marines that I was working with. These were F-18 pilots, Harrier pilots, C-130 pilots that had all done some tour. And they were in these documentaries as JTACs or forward air controllers embedded with Marine units, holding an M4, getting shot at, calling in close air support. And then they would rotate back to the air wing and, go fly the F-18 again or whatever it might be, which now it doesn't happen in the Air Force. It used to be they'd pull fighter pilots, go do a JTAC tour occasionally, but now it's a whole separate career track. So you don't get that guys going as pilots being embedded with ground units for the most part. So,
well, the Marines started flying close air support and sending pilots out as observers. During the Second World War in the Philippines, now General MacArthur. MacArthur wasn't a fan of it initially, but his generals, they saw what was going on and they loved it. The Marines have always sent pilots out because pilots know how to talk to the guys. I mean, I can remember one day I was talking to one of the pilots that was flying and dropping for us, and the radio operator next to me asked me, "Do you know that guy?" I said, "Yeah, that's Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so." He says, "Lieutenant Colonel," says, "you're calling him such and such." I said, "Yeah, well, that's his call sign." But I knew the guys that were in the airplanes. A lot of them, not all of them, but I knew a lot of the guys. And I knew how close they could, I could feel safe with some of those guys dropping weapons. I can remember one day, Mike Riley, company commander. Mike wanted me to drop about 50 meters. He wanted us to drop, shoot guns about 50 meters away and drop napalm about 75 meters from the line. And the pilot wouldn't do it. And Mike says, "Give me that radio." He got on the phone, he got on the radio and said, "This is Mike 6 actual. So I got two choices. You can kill me, or the NBA can kill me. I'm betting on you. Just drop the damn bombs when we asked for them." And we did. He says, "I'll make sure everybody stays down." We had one kid that got hit in the hand with a piece of shrapnel. Mike was furious because the kid was taking a picture with his camera, and he had a piece of shrapnel in his hand. Mike was furious that the kid got hurt because he got hit. He'd have been down where he should have been,
right
in a hole, hiding behind the log or something.
That's close. Again, for those who don't realize, 75 meters. And if you're talking dropping napalm at 75 meters, I cannot even imagine what the...
You feel the heat. But there's nothing like watching napalm go in when somebody's dropping it on you is terrible. But dropping it for you and just in front of you is the greatest feeling in the world, because that whoever's down there receiving that stuff is going to get fried. Not everybody did. Some of them got down the hole, covered up, and they might have got the back burned and lost some of the air, but the flame would
It's actually incredible to see what people can survive through, because, I mean, it's not uncommon to, I mean, saw multiple times a 500-pound, I mean, I dropped on a truck, pickup truck, hit right behind the cab, and then the driver got out and took off running down the road. Yeah, the fact that you can survive a 500-pound weapon blowing up a foot behind you is incredible, or a bunch of napalm going off on top of you and just get a little warm. It's weird.
Well, I don't think there was ever a time when we dropped something on the air. We didn't have to go come through, clear it out, and finish the job.
I would like to talk real quick, too, before we kind of start wrapping up here. You ended up flying CH-53s. Is that correct?
I did. I was at the basic school as an instructor, and I got promoted to major. And I got a set of orders to helicopter transition. They were short majors in the helicopter program. And that year, they took seven of us, and they made us transition to helicopters. And they were all guys who were in non-flying billets. Mine was a non-flying billet. And they transitioned to helicopters and told us we had to do it for 3 years, and then we could go back. Well, I transitioned. I was supposed to be a 46 replacement. I got to New River Air Station. The group commander asked me, would I mind flying at 53? I said, not at all. He says, you don't want to fly the 46? I said, sir, the only plane I've ever crashed in is a 46. If I don't have to fly, it's going to be fine with me. When I went out to be a forward air controller, I went up to the wing helipad at Da Nang and to get a flight up towards Dong Ha. And I got on at 46, and we got up in the air, the thing lost power, and crashed. A little over to burn. I got on the Huey. The next thing that was going my way was the Huey. I sat there with my feet hanging out the door of the Huey, flying up to the bank or Dong Ha, thinking this is not a good way to start my forward air controller story.
So foreshadowing.
53 pilot. And to be honest with you, I didn't want to do it, but I ended up liking it. And I had a chance to stick around or to go back. And I thought, I did not want to go back to the A6s. Be one of those pilots that some poor lieutenant or captain had a transition, some field grade officer had to do the transition right to the airplane. And I was going to get in the queue for a squadron with a bunch of guys who'd been flying the whole time, but I hadn't. I thought if I stayed in the 53s, I could get a squadron. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a squadron commander. I didn't care whether it was helicopters or fixed wing airplane. So I stuck around, and the group commander and I saw things the same way. He was a great guy, and promised me a 53 squadron, and I got it. I was thrilled.
The funny thing about the 53, I was actually flying out of a small airfield in Florida. It was Sikorsky. It's a private field where they do a lot of their developmental tests. Then bought by Lockheed, but they have the 53K that was going through its development and test while I was down there. And I remember they put this thing out on like the north end of the field. They chained it down, and then the test pilots would get in it and operate it, whatever power limit they were testing, right? And it was chain this thing to the ground and just hover for like 6 hours at 80% or whatever it was. But that was the test. It was just to strain the motors in the aircraft for as long as possible with resistance. And I thought, that looks terrible. You know, helicopters in my mind are just shaking themselves apart. So from a guy who's flying fast jets to go fly the helicopter, that'd be playing in the back of your mind, especially since you crashed in a CH-46.
Well, flying helicopters, I thought, was really relatively easy. It took me 3 flights to learn how to hover. And I think I could have gone out for an hour each time or 30 minutes each time. It wouldn't gonna matter. I just needed 3 experiences. And I learned how to hover. Once you learn how to hover a helicopter, it's easy. You do everything at the same speed. And you're down low the whole time. So 53 was a very good instrument platform. And I used to love to fly instruments in the 53. most helicopter pilots learn to fly VFR. I can remember once coming down from New York, a co-pilot with a young captain. We were flying, we got to New York, and the flight system through New York City was to go over the George Washington Bridge at 700 feet and fly down the Hudson River, 700 feet or below. We got to the Arizona Bridge. We're getting lower and lower, and the weather's getting shittier and shittier, and I'm telling this guy, you need to call center and get a clearance. And I'm a big believer that if you climb up into instrument airspace and be at a VFR altitude, there's not going to be anybody at your altitude, your VFR altitude. But you're going to be where you don't belong. And when you call somebody up and tell them I'm VFR in the goo, such and such place, they're going to find you as fast as they can and get you out of there. If you call them and tell them you're VFR, they're going to get to you when they have time. But this pilot would not try to go for instruments. We got closer and closer. I'm looking over at the Staten Island, thinking to myself, the Verrazano Bridge is really close. And I grew up in near northern Jersey. I've been in the canoe through the harbor under the Verrazano Bridge. I knew exactly where the ferry from Staten Island was. I knew where the Verrazano Bridge was. I grabbed the controls and I pulled up. And I can tell you, Sergeant Frank was the crew chief. I think he was the staff sergeant. And he said that we almost hit the big cable, the big thick cable that held up the bridge as we went through the dip and the low spot of the bridge. And it scared the hell out of me.
Yeah, but I bet.
This guy did not want to fly VFR or fly IFR. And I just wanted to stay VFR. We would have flown right into that bridge if I hadn't known where it was. I'm convinced.
Oh, geez. Yeah. For some reason. Yeah. Hilo guys just, they like being low and they like being VFR. I can't blame them, but, you know, IFR, it's not the scariest thing, you know, unless you never do it. But I would like to ask, so you retired from the Marine Corps and slightly different path than I think most people do. Most people end up in some kind of flying job post-military, especially if they were a pilot in the military. Mm-hmm. But you ended up becoming a high school biology teacher and then became assistant principal and principal of a high school. What kind of led you down that path?
I had a chance to fly when I got out of the Marine Corps. I went down, a friend of mine was the chief pilot down at Delaware for one of the big corporations down there, one of the chemical companies. And he took me down. He wanted me to come fly with them. And I looked at the planes they had. They had a Gulfstream 5 and a Lockheed Lodestar. It's a really nice airplane. I found out what they did, I thought to myself, this is going to be worse than the Marine Corps. These guys are gone every morning, never around. They have to get up early, pre-flight the airplane, get it loaded up, take somebody where they want to go, hang around until they're ready to come home, go to Europe in a minute's notice. I want to have breakfast with my kids and be with my family. And so I took a job as a teacher so that I had a small horse farm. We bought a 40-acre farm, 30 acres, and then they had 10 acres later on. And I figured I had the opportunity to spend the summers building a horse barn, do the things I wanted to do. And I took the assistant principal's job. The same reason, to the assistant principal's job. And initially, I only worked 8 months out of, I guess 10 months out of the year. And I had the summers off. And so that was pretty good. I eventually became the principal. But it's funny, I was back at the school a couple months ago, and I haven't been there since 2002. So I've been gone 20 years. And I ran into one of the guidance counselors that I had hired. She's still there. And she says, we were talking about you the other day. I said, why are you talking about me? She said, we could use you back here. I thought I'd last 10 minutes. I mean, I ran the school the way I ran my squadron. I did what I thought was the right thing. And I believe that you had to treat everybody the same. And when good kids behave badly, they are treated like bad kids. When bad kids behave well, they are treated like good kids. But I was the kind of guy who believed that we could do things that gave students, made them feel like they had some responsibility, and that they had some control of where they were going to go and what they were going to do. I initiated student projects in the school. I had, you know, you talk about the benches. I eventually went down to the ag shop. I asked the ag kids to build me some new benches. And they did. And when we were done, I went down. I bought pizza and Cokes. And we brought the benches out, put them where the old ones had been, and sat there, and we had pizza and Cokes while everybody inside can see it, and we're outside enjoying ourselves. And then I said to the agent, I said, "Now, don't let anybody trash these benches, because I hate to have to burn your benches like I burned the other ones." Well, I think those benches are probably still there, and they still don't have anything written on them.
Well, I would say, I venture to say, probably most schools today could use a retired Marine running and doing a lot of influence around there. That's something, again, I think that's a profound statement when you see, and I know that had to be etched in the minds of those students, seeing those things lit on fire and then just gone, right? Like, dad's not messing around anymore. You know, it's serious. And that's something that's kind of, I think, lacking today.
Well, and the students know that if they mess up the new benches, they're going to have the ag kids were going to go kick their ass.
Right. Yeah.
But I was going to let it happen.
you have buy-in and ownership that way, right? You know, it's, that's how you get it. And there's going to be some ownership of that. Well, sir, I would like to say thank you for joining me on the podcast. Before we depart, you got a lot of experience under your belt. If you found yourself, your teenage you, walking on the street today, would there be any advice you'd give him? Any tips, tricks, or tell him to do something different?
I don't know if I tell him to do things differently, because I probably wouldn't know what he was up to. But I'd probably tell him the things that I learned. I think there was a guy named Paul Ricks called The Lessons from Paris Island. And one of those lessons is do the best that you can, even when nobody's watching you. And do the difficult right thing instead of the easy wrong thing. It's so easy for kids to do what their friends want them to do instead of what they know is right. Kids know what's the right thing to do. The thing they got to do is to do it. And I would tell them, you're going to be better off doing what you know is right. You got to feel better about yourself, and other people are going to feel better about you doing that. There's a few other things I'd probably tell them as well. Those are probably the first couple of things I'd tell them.
Well, sir, again, thank you for taking the time today to share your stories. To me, they're, you know, very interesting and incredible, just to jump back in time into a different era and a whole different set of problems and things to have to solve. But hearing, you know, the fighter pilot come out is pretty awesome. So thanks again for taking the time today and sharing your journey.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening in today. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Again, you can swing over to the afterburnpodcast.com. You'll find links to Patreon over there. You can watch this episode as well as Afterburn Podcast shop. Until next time, don't bring a week.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.